today's liturgy sets before us another banquet, a lot to reflect on. We have another great saint today, Saint Agatha, and then we have this passage in today's gospel about Jesus' experience when he returned to Nazareth and was ultimately rejected by his own townspeople, and then in the letter to the Hebrews, which we're nearing the end of now, an instruction on how suffering can be interpreted as discipline from the Lord. What do these three have to do with each other? It seems to me the liturgy is instructing us about how faith takes us outside the expectations of the society and the family. It's a kind of violation of what's expected. So let's start with Saint Agatha, another one of these famous virgin martyrs of the early church. We just had Saint Agnes a couple of weeks ago, now Saint Agatha. There's something about the virgin martyrs which really inspired the early church, and so they're still honored to this day, and the name of Agatha is even included in the first Eucharistic prayer, the Roman canon. So is Agnes, so is Cecilia. What this reveals is that the church recognizes that holiness of life is not just limited to the people who are mentioned in the Bible. It's not surprising that the church's official prayer would include mention of the apostles or John the Baptist or Mary Magdalene or people that are in the Bible. But what about these people who lived in the second, third, fourth century? They're holy too. They can be held up the way the biblical figures are and included in our official prayer, in the liturgical prayer. Yes. It's as if the holiness that we see in the apostles or in the scriptures, it continues to overflow right into the centuries. So Saint Agatha is one of them. Now, when we interpret the victory of someone like Agatha, virgin and martyr, we have to understand something about her culture, and that's a little difficult because every culture is a little different. Certainly in those times, a woman was expected to marry and for the most part was given in marriage. It wasn't so much a choice of the woman as a choice of her family, of her clan. That can be exaggerated too. Sometimes people say that women in the ancient days were just considered property. No, they weren't considered property, but they did have limitations in how much their decision influenced their marriage. They could say no. It depends. Now, this is Sicily. Agatha is living in Sicily, and she's from a noble family, so I don't know all the details there. But usually, if a woman really didn't want to marry somebody, they could have a say in it. But to marry nobody, that's a big violation of the social expectation. So they say this is what faith does. It elevates us out of the expectations of our family and of our culture in such a way that it can be very offensive. So for a young, beautiful woman to say, I'm not going to marry anybody, is like an insult to the culture or to a breaking of the social contract, you might say. And it makes people angry. And we see this again and again in the case of the early, or these virgin martyrs. Why do they get killed? I mean, it's one thing to say, well, if you don't want to get married, well, that's your problem. But to say, because you're doing that, you have to be destroyed. It's because of that it's as if there's people feel a rejection of their whole culture, a rejection of their very being. And this Agatha is so insulting that she has to be tortured and killed. And she endures it. She holds on to her love for Jesus Christ to the point of shedding blood. The letter to the Hebrews says, you have not yet resisted sin to the point of shedding blood. Well, Agatha did, and she comes out victorious. But the point that I want to make here is that there's something about faith which is always going to violate some human standards, natural, cultural, family standards. And that's why we keep seeing these stories of the martyrs. We're going to see it again tomorrow with the Japanese martyrs. Is it tomorrow? Or yeah, tomorrow. The Japanese martyrs did the same thing. I mean, it's one thing for foreigners to be Christians, but for Japanese to be Christians, that's just too much of an upheaval in the culture. And eventually, no, these people have to be destroyed. Okay, we'll get to that tomorrow. Now, in the case of Jesus, he goes back to Nazareth. Now, yesterday we heard that he cured a woman who was afflicted with hemorrhage for 12 years, and he raised a little girl back to life from the dead. So, and he said, don't tell anybody about this. But of course, the word spread that this man, Jesus, is an extraordinary wonder worker and a great preacher. And he goes back to Nazareth and he teaches in the synagogue, and it says, many who heard him were astonished. There's something very astonishing about Jesus, just his words, much less his miraculous deeds. But then they start raising these objections, and we know this is what happened in Nazareth. They said, well, he's one of us. He's just a carpenter. We know his mother. We know his brothers and sisters. And who is this? Who is he to claim to be more than he is? It says that they took offense at him. Again, it's a case of somebody violating the social contract, the expectations of the culture. And again, now it's not recounted in Mark's gospel, but we know from Luke's gospel, the people were so offended by that they wanted to destroy him, much like the people in Sicily, or especially the leader, wanted to destroy Agatha. Now, when we reflect on the people of Nazareth, we should also remember that Nazareth had a very bad reputation in the first place. Can anything good come from Nazareth? It was a really low quality town, and anyone from Nazareth was automatically looked down on anyway. So it's as if the people of Nazareth had a low view of themselves. And so to have someone from among them, especially a carpenter, a worker, stand up and act as if he's someone important, well, it's just too big an insult. So they're astonished at his wisdom, but they're also offended. And at the end of the gospel, he's amazed at them too. He's amazed at their lack of faith, that they can't see beyond the prejudice that comes with being from Nazareth. It's amazing. It doesn't matter how many miracles he does, it's not going to break through those blinders of prejudice. Now, we are all products of our families and our cultures and of modern society, and there are lots of expectations of how we're supposed to be, how we're supposed to interact with one another, how we're supposed to participate in society and family. And that's all good. That's how the human family grows. But it's not the final word. It's not the absolute standard or the criterion that we follow. God is the criterion. The will of God is our ultimate criterion. And sometimes the will of God moves us to step outside the boundaries of what is expected of us. And when that happens, we experience rejection, persecution on some level. And that takes us to this reading from the letter to the Hebrews. And he's spoken about persecution already in the past couple of days. And here he picks up where we left off yesterday, that we have not yet, in our struggle against sin, we have not yet resisted to the point of shedding blood. Okay, that shows how serious the battle is. But then the author of Hebrews, brings up this interpretation of suffering as discipline. The discipline of a loving father for his children. What son is there whom his father does not discipline? And discipline always seems like a bad thing when we experience it. But eventually, when we look back, we can see how fruitful it is to have been disciplined, and we give thanks. Now, that works even on a human level for a little while. And in the spiritual life, we can use certain human standards and say, well, okay, I can see why it might be a good thing for me to experience failure so that I'm humbled. Or I can see, even if my rational mind, aside from faith, I can see that sometimes it's good for me to not be able to achieve my goals, or to have someone misunderstand me, or for me to be humiliated in public sometimes, because even though I hate that, well, you know, I can see that there's some good fruit of it. And so we can kind of get to the point where we say, well, we understand discipline because we've raised our own children and we know that it was good to discipline them, and now that they benefit from it. But there's a limit to how much we can grasp on that level, because what about when it comes to shedding blood? What about when it comes to severe persecution? Then it doesn't make sense to us anymore as a discipline. Like, this is a good thing for me, even though I don't like it. You can imagine Agatha, who was treated very, very harshly, very humiliating abuse and painful abuse. And there's no way she could say, oh, this is a good thing for me, because I'm going to be a better person afterwards. That would not work anymore. In fact, she was killed. I mean, where's the good now? Where's the good fruit? Well, that's where we have to transcend our human standards. Again, this is my whole point of this little reflection, that there's something higher than our human and natural standards, and that is the will of God. So that's why this reading from Hebrews helps us. Okay, our Father who loves us and wants what is good for us, disciplines us. He allows us to experience humiliation, sufferings, trials, all different kinds, for our own good. And that experience can be to the point of our death. And then if we say, well, what good is that? We say, well, it's for our eternal good. It's for our eternal good. And the real goal here is not just to be a good person or to be a wise person. It's to be united with God. It's eternal glory. And that can't be fully achieved in this life. So we have to be stripped of our human expectations and whatever we may cling to. The letter to the Hebrews says, well, strengthen your drooping hands and your weak knees. Make straight paths for your feet, that what is lame may not be dislocated but healed. Be strong. Persevere. Not with human strength alone, but with the strength that comes from trusting in God. This is the strength that Agatha reveals. She was not a strong person. She was a young woman. I don't know how old she was when she was killed, but I mean, she was no gladiator, you know, standing up and fighting against the Roman centurions or something. No, she was a young girl, but she strengthened her drooping hands and her weak knees because she put all her trust in God, and that opened the door for her to be very strong, stronger than her persecutors, stronger than death. That's why we find the martyrs so inspiring. Okay, so this is where we are. We're not just living on a natural level. We are called to holiness, and we're called to eternal life. So whenever there's an issue or a conflict between our natural goods or natural life and our supernatural life, whenever there's a conflict between the will of man and the will of God, we choose God. We choose eternal life, and keep doing that with strength, and God provides for our victory.